Accession number 28670, this is David Wilson, Reel 2. Now, we're talking about your time as a child, you know, between 5 and 11, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
In Shiremore, during the Second World War. Any other stories, during the wartime or that illustrate life in the village?
Well, it's, I suppose, being fairly young during that time, the school and school days were the most prominent things in my mind, and there was this general picture of getting back to the food rationing. I remember them issuing large tins of powdered egg and powdered chocolate, and he used to come to the schools and used to take it home. And I recall he used to mix the powdered chocolate with sugar and sort of wet your finger and dip it in, you know, and it was a sweet, I suppose, because there wasn't sweets available. In fact, the only things that were available were quite horrible in the sweet form. I recall a little shop at Shiremore, a bloke called Tommy Townsend, and he used to sell stuff, and he got a batch of, I mean, this was at a stage where you were talking about one old halfpenny of sweets, and you could get a great big bag for it, you know. Well, wouldn't have had them. But anyway, I remember going into the shop and with a whole stack of kids with the halfpennies, and the kid in front of me said, "Halfpenny licorice?" And he says, he was a bit of a wag, he says, "Do you want a long halfpenny or a short halfpenny?" And the kid obviously says, "I want a long halfpenny." So he got this licorice, a stick of licorice, and he stretched it a couple of feet long and says, "There you are, lad, like, here's your long halfpenny." So and so. But the only other stuff was stuff like that arrowroot stuff. It's a licorice root that used to chew on and suck, you know, horrible, really. So in that respect, I suppose I'm deprived of little treats. You know, there wasn't any sweets or anything like that. But generally speaking, it was apart from the bombing and that, it was.
Were you aware of the bombing of Newcastle and the dock areas? Would you ever go into Newcastle?
Oh no, it was all life was very parochial. It was I mean, everybody that was working just cycled to the colliery, or I cannot remember being connected with anybody that worked in Newcastle from our family. They all worked at the pit, and they either walked there or cycled there. But you knew about damage. I remember this might be in retrospect, because you see photographs in the Evening Chronicle and this sort of thing, the Newcastle paper, of the damage to the Manor's goods yard and the houses on Matthew Bank that had been bombed and all that sort of thing. Talking about bombed houses, we used to play as kids in the wreck of the old houses in Duchess Street and Louisa Street at Shiremore. They remained all during the war just as derelict shells. In fact, some of them weren't even shells. It was just rubble.
So what would you play in them? I mean, I think I imagine. What would you do in a bomb
there? We used to. I remember. One thing I know we did do was pinch the doweling out of the plaster doweling. The doweling in the corner of the old buildings is round softwood, and we used to get long lengths of that and make swords and chase around doing a Robin Hood bit, like, you know, and Sheriff of Nottingham and this sort of thing, after having seen it at the Gaff at Shiremore. The Gaff was the nickname of the New Palace Picture Hall was its proper name, and of course Cowboys and Indians was favourite.
So you'd play that round the bomb down?
Round the bombs. And of course,
Were they sort of wired off? I mean, were you meant to be in there?
Oh, no, they weren't wired off. There wasn't any restriction at all. We just used to run about without being chased away from them. Matter of fact, I was next door to the colliery streets. I was also the old slag heap from the Bluebell Colliery, which was, by then, it had been closed for quite a number of years. It was a very old colliery. But the sheer legs and all of the outbuildings were still there, in a coal depot where they used to load the coal onto the carts, because the pitmen used to get free coal. It was part of their wages, and the old coal, the horse, the big old Clydesdale horse with the loads of coal on the back, used to come around the street dumping it. That's another thing, slightly humorous thing. The coal houses along with the toilets were in between the streets. We used to play some horrible tricks, really. The people would start, the blokes would come from work and they would have that tea and they would start putting the coal in, that load of coal, which was quite a considerable heap of coal. And we'd wait till they started shoveling them into the hatch on the roadside of the coal house. We used to go and open the door on the other side, unbeknown to them, and they were casting the coal straight through onto the path between the houses, straight through the coal house. And then we used to beat it, because they had to put it in twice, because when they went around and found that it was all on the outside, they had to shovel it in from the other side. So that was the sort of horrible trick that kids got up to, of course.
Now, so what goes on as you're getting older towards the end of the war? I mean, were you ever involved in any sort of the Boy Scouts or anything, or any war effort at all?
No, I was never involved in the Scouts. The player used to be generally in around the colliery yard, and it did, as you got a bit older, it tended to be a bit more military, I suppose. As a matter of fact, I recall one slightly older lad who we used to get old pieces of timber from the railings in the colliery yard, and he had this the knack of making up these what looked a bit like 303s rifles, and used to put a bolt on the side and of course get a bit of belting from the colliery and make a sling, so that it had quite authentic, and we used to march up and down the streets with these things. I recall when I first saw them, I coveted it, I needed it, and I pleaded with this kid to make me one, and he eventually did, and I thought that was marvellous, and we marched up and down the streets proper military style, you know, with the rifles and the bolt on the side and the belting sling, you know. And so I suppose...
How many of you?
Oh, quite a few. Maybe it's about a dozen. And that was really, I suppose, that was another aspect to it. That was gangs. Again, even at that stage, there was the Backworth gang used to come and raid the Shiremore gang, who were placed in strategic position on top of the Bluebell heap and throw stones up and down and this sort of thing, you know. So it got a bit more serious and a bit more dangerous as you got older, I suppose.
Now, what were the gangs? Because it's got the name, they weren't as serious as gangs now.
Oh, no, it was...
What was your gang?
Top Shire gang. Again, it was all very... sort of low key stuff, just simply being a member of the Shiremore gang. Again, I think it's partly the fact that the life was parochial, that you felt that somebody from the next door village was a stranger. And there was rivalry, let's say, you know, there was rivalry in between Shire. Even in the village of Shiremore, if you lived over the bridge, there was Top Shire and Bottom Shire, and of course the Backworth gang, the where the colliery was, and all sorts of lurid tales about what would happen to you if the caught you and this sort of thing, which is all rubbish really, but just rivalry. It wasn't terribly friendly, but it was rivalry. But it never got any worse than sort of throwing stones or something of that nature, you know. And then, of course, as time went on, personally, I remember just towards the end of the war when various me pals, fathers who had been working at the quarry and hadn't been away in the forces, started to buy things like motorcycles, BSA, Gold Star and this sort of thing, and being really interested. That was a sort of a good time for me, because this idea of having a motorbike was something I aspired to, you know, and seeing these machines and getting the odd ride on a pillion and this sort of thing, really I found, you know, very pleasurable indeed.
So it was motorcycles more than cars?
Well, there wasn't any cars about. There was, in fact, when I started work at 15, I could go from Shire Moor on the bus, and you were almost into Newcastle proper, you say up to Benton, or Matthew Bank at Gosforth, before you saw a car at all. Very few and far between. So motorbikes were the thing. There was plenty of motorbikes used to turn out in, and pushbikes.
Now, what about at the end of the war? Were there any street parties? I mean, you'd be 11 then, I think. Yes, 11. Would there be any street parties organised? Either V-Day, VJ-Day, or anything else?
It's, you know, the strange thing is, although I've seen photographs of people, you know, having street parties, I cannot honestly recall having been to a street party.
When your dad came, when your dad came back, I mean, I know he'd been back on leave, but he'd also been away most of the time. But this wasn't coming back for a week or 2 weeks or a couple of days. This was coming back for good.
Yeah.
You're 11. He'd gone when you were five.
Yeah.
Five or six. How was it between you and your dad when he came back? And was it a bit strange?
Strange, yeah. It was strange and quite strained.
In what way? Could you talk a bit about it? I know it might be quite difficult.
He was a stranger, really. It was interesting getting used to having him about. I didn't have any strong memories of him beforehand. And I recall him going through the throes of deciding whether he was going back to the colliery or not, and debating if he could get a job bus driving and this sort of thing. But eventually he went back to the colliery anyway. There was a strain. It was my mother that always sort of ran things and was the provider, and she was quite marvellous, like that whole generation of women that could produce meals out of nothing and clothes out of almost nothing. You know, they were tremendous.
How did he behave when he came? Some of them had a lot of trouble getting back to civilian life. How was he? Did he settle down quickly, or did he show signs of what he'd been through?
I believe he settled down quite quickly. I cannot recall. He obviously talked a lot about the army and about Jib, and he still had some of his old pals who lived relatively close, army pals that he used to communicate with, and on occasion we went to Durham to a pal of his, but the whole era seemed to fade into, once he got to start at the colliery again, he slipped back into the in a normal life quite reasonably well, you know. It was there wasn't any sort of long periods, there wasn't any upheaval in the house, so, and he tended to be he had a short fuse. He was the sort of person who hit the roof at next to nothing, and like all that generation of men, he was a bit chauvinistic, you know, had to have everything done for him. But he was all right.
But he'd been like that before.
He had been like that before, so it was nothing new, you know. It was, yeah.
Now, what? So you're going through your education, you know. I don't know, the post-war period, the next thing would be leaving school at 14, I presume.
I was the first year to leave at 15, a year prior to me. So it would be 1948, I think. Well, the birthday being in January, the 3rd of January, I was left at Christmas 48. And that was the first year that the kids left school at 15. So I was actually 15 year old. By that time, I'd become a school prefect and sort of was one of the big cheeses.
So,
right, you know.
So that was 1948?
48.
48?
Christmas 48, yeah.
Wouldn't you be just 14 still then?
Well, yeah, I was just 14. I was, yeah.
Right. So, what were you going to do? Who'd got you a job, and were you going to go down the pit? What was planned for you?
Well, of course, that was one thing. My father said, "You're not going down the pit." That was about as much as he contributed towards the whole problem of getting a job, because you left school on the Friday. And you were expected down at the, it was Livingston Hall in Whitley Bay, and it was the, I suppose they used to call it the Dole at the time, but it was a sort of job centre. It was...
Labour Exchange.
The Labour Exchange, that's it. Went down there and signed on, went through the formalities and they asked you what you fancied, and I said, I don't want to be a motor mechanic, so they gave me a card to take out to the Daimler Motor Company, which had a repair shop in Whitley Bay. And I went round there, but what they wanted, you had to start on the stalls bike initially. And the idea was that you progressed into the workshop and started a proper apprenticeship. But the stores bike idea didn't appeal to me at all. So I said no, I turned it down and went back to the Labour Exchange. And then they sent me around to the Whitley Bay Motor Company, who were the Roots Group dealers, the Hillman and Humber dealers. And I got a start there. I only worked there for about 3 months. And my uncle, ex-naval man, now out of the forces, rang around and he got me an interview at Murray and Charlton's, the Austin distributors in Newcastle, and I got a job there, and I started serving my apprenticeship there. Worked through 40, so that took...
Now what was an apprenticeship?
Well, it was a 5-year apprenticeship and it was indentured.
So you'd start in 49 effectively?
I started Whitley Bay Motor Company January of 49. Worked about 3 months, so it was getting on well up towards the end of 49 by the time we got round to the job. I actually started serving my apprenticeship in January 1950, because that was on your 16th birthday, you know. And the idea was you worked through at 21.
What was an apprenticeship? Can you just explain what the idea was?
Well, it was under the auspices of the National Joint Industrial Council. I still got my card for it, and you started as an apprentice. You were apprenticed to a tradesman, so that the system was that every working bay in the garage workshop had fully time-served motor mechanic and an apprentice, and you worked with him till you were perhaps 17, and if you were any good by the time you were sort of 17 and a half, you started getting work of your own generally under supervision. But if you, as I say, you ended up quite often you found that some of the apprentices became just as good and sometimes better than some of the old lags, you know. But you actually weren't on full money till you became 21. But of course, being keen to do my national service, I didn't defer my national service. I went in when I was 18.
Now, what were the skills you had to learn as an apprentice motor mechanic?
Well,
just to summarise, because we're going to do a lot of this when we come into the army, but
of course.
I'm trying to get what you got when you went in.
Well, at that stage, in the 50s, what you had was the vehicles were relatively old and primitive that you worked on, because it was a time when all of the pre-war stuff, which had been languishing on bricks and in garages and in gardens and this sort of thing, were all trundled out. I mean, this was at the time of the export and die, export or die situation, where all motor cars were going for export. Very few came onto the home market. And so all of this pre-war stuff, and even stuff as far back as the 20s, was seen on the roads. It was quite reasonable stuff. So the skills that you learned were basic engineering and fitting skills, as well as the theory of motor vehicle technology. So you had to be, it wasn't just a question, as it's developed now, of changing units, fitting things. You actually repaired things. You had a machine shop. There was a lathe, grinder, milling machine, and you made things up. You overhauled gearboxes and rear axles and differentials and engines, reballs and white metal bearings and everything from A to Z. So it was a grounding in mechanical engineering as well as motor vehicle. And I found that it sort of served me in good stead, because I think I had a better understanding of the product, of the actual vehicle itself, whereas anybody now simply by comparison just being involved with diagnostic stuff, with mainly electronic stuff, doesn't necessarily have to know about how an engine operates or even take it to bits and put it back together again, you know. So it was a different era as far as the skills were concerned.
Were you enjoying it?
Oh, yeah. The best time of working life was serving my apprenticeship. I enjoyed the army when I went in, but I think it was only a couple of years at that stage, but it was a good time. And you felt quite when you assimilated the skills, you felt it was quite prestigious. You thought, I'm really somebody. I can take a gearbox to bits and put it back together again, and it works. And you know, I was quite proud of being a decent motor mechanic.
Now, as you're getting older, did you have any big hobbies other than playing with engines?
No, it mainly
sport
was. It was mainly, if there was any sport, it was motor sport. I did get involved with actually in later on. As a kid, everybody played football, but I must admit I was more drawn towards technical things than actually going out with the lads. And I was in the house team at school. I had a four house system. I was Alec. This was the secondary modern school. Alec, Otterburn, Bamborough and Hexham, the four county towns in Northumberland, or big towns in Northumberland. And I played for Alec, and we did quite well. And I was quite a reasonable right fullback. I didn't really get into it the way the other lads did, you know me.
What about other recreational hobbies? I mean, were you in the Boy Scouts or anything?
No, I was never in the Scouts. I had the opportunity to go to the Cubs originally when we lived at Shire Moor, because the church was just over the road. In fact, it was next door to the crater that the bomb had left.
But you weren't in any...
No.
And you weren't in the ARP boys or anything like that?
No, Army, nothing like that. It was all...
Not a runner for the Home Guard or anything like
no,
that?
No, well, I wasn't old enough for that, but the... it was. I suppose it was the age group that I was in. You grew up during the war, and as soon as the war finished, you were more or less precipitated into work, you know, it was...
So how would you spend... I mean, were you drinking by that? I mean, I know you're underage, but it doesn't mean you...
Well, the first drink that I ever had, again, was with some of the pals from Murray and Charlton's, was at the Sun Inn in Benton, I remember. And, of course, a pint made you go all woozy anyway, like, you know. Never a big drinker. Social drinker. And used to get down to Whitley Bay to the fun fair with the Murray and Charlton's crowd at a weekend.
Cinema? Were you a big cinema guy?
Yeah, yeah. Well, prior to working even, the cinema in Shire Moor, the local cinema, used to do 3-4 changes of programmes a week. You had Monday and Tuesday was one. And, of course, that was at a time when you got the feature film, plus travelogues, plus a support film like Edgar Kennedy or The Three Stooges or Old Mother Riley or something like that. So you had a good programme. So that was Monday and Tuesday was one programme. Wednesday was on its own, was a secondary programme. And Thursday, Friday and Saturday was one. And then on a Sunday evening, they had another. So you had 4 changes and went to every one. Because it was something like 7 old pennies, this is, in the front row, 10 pence in the rest of the downstairs, and a shilling in the balcony. You know, and we used to go in the 70s, of course. In fact, I recall earlier, when we were kids, earlier in the war, you could even take jam jars to the cinema to get in. You'd swap it for a ticket, you know.
Would you go dancing much?
Yes, I met my wife when in a dance, but this was after I came out of the army.
But before, would you go as a young lad, 16, 17, 18?
To Whitley Bay, we did come down to Whitley Bay, but it was generally just to the fun fair. There was a big dance hall.
The fun fair there just in the summer?
No, it was permanent. It was permanent.
What was it
the Spanish City. Oh, there was the figure of eight, I remember, a rickety thing, which is a bit like the sort of Skylon type of thing, where you go, you know, the Big Dipper and this type of thing. It was a wooden framed affair, which was a bit on the rickety side. Figure of eight, and of course the waltzer, and which if you had a couple of pints and you went in fish and chips and you went on that, yeah, ended up very nauseated to say the least. But it was a permanent, yeah, it was all year round.
So you'd go quite often to that?
Oh yes, we did. Whitley Bay was where we spent most of our time. It's only 3.5 miles down the road on the coast.
You go by bus or walk?
Bus, oh yeah, yeah, bus. The bus, the public transport system in the area was superb. You only had to wait at the very most 15 minutes between buses coming, and of course that was the electric train, which is now the metro system, you know.